I know. Bow. Bow. Bow.
Hello and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm podcast. I am your host, KMO, and this is episode number 523, Stet, with guest James Howard Kunstler, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Wednesday, April 11th, 2018. Boy, that last number on the year just changes with shocking frequency. 2018 is the year. I turned 50 this month. That seems like it should be sobering. And I guess I am sober. But I don't know. It hasn't quite hit me yet. It could be an effect of the fact that I'm around a lot of people who are much older than 50. And to them, 50 is young. I heard a few years back that 50 is the new 30. And I don't quite know what this means, but I'd rather think that 50 is the new 50. That 50 isn't what it used to be. But I don't feel 30. Anyway, what you'll hear in this episode of the Sea Realm podcast is a conversation with James Howard Kunstler. And as Jim will explain in the conversation, he was here in Bellows Falls. This was recorded at my kitchen table, which I don't eat at so much. It's really a workspace. But it was recorded here, where I record the Sea Realm podcast and draw the comics and such. And Jim drove up here to interview me for a book project that he's doing. I don't know how much he's allowed to say about the book in advance, but he did mention that he's interviewing people for it. And I was the second interview, but possibly the first interview that will actually appear in the book. I don't know when the book is due out, given the speed of official publishing, probably not for a couple years. But of course, while he was here, I turned on the recorder and re-recorded some stuff for the Sea Realm podcast. I cut out about the first 15 minutes of this recording, maybe a little more than that, because it was exceedingly, exceedingly casual. But I will put some of that in the Sea Realm Vault podcast that will come out this coming weekend. Some of it is inappropriate even for the Vault. So Jim was here for, I think, 5 or 6 hours total. And we didn't have recorders running the whole time. We did talk for a long time and, you know, went out for lunch, came back. And recording for the Sea Realm podcast was the last thing we did. So there are many references to things spoken of earlier, which you will not have heard. But whenever that happens, we do attempt at least a recap. But the point at which I'm going to play this recording for you is where I asked Jim about his relationship to his blog. Because a lot of what we talked about earlier in the day was making a living in this weird world where old means of making a living have fallen away, and the high-profile new means of making a living don't employ that many people. So Jim publishes a blog. It comes out twice a week, and he receives very generous support from his readers via Patreon. So here's that conversation with James Howard Kunstler.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast. C stands for consciousness.
Make a mighty leap.
Wouldn't even be mighty for you. You're such a good leaper.
And I'm talking to Mocha the cat, not Kamo.
Yeah. So I'm interested in your relationship to your blog.
Oh.
You write twice a week, right?
I do. I upped it to twice a week because, book publishing is getting to be a very sketchy thing for most authors. What used to be called mid-list authors, which means mostly everybody in the middle, the people who aren't total failures, but the people who aren't really making a whole lot of money for the publishers. And you used to be able to make a decent living for a book advance that would take you 2 or 3 years to write the book. And you'd get paid a little bit more than a junior high school janitor, But now book advances are really, really low. And I needed to find another way to, make a living in this economy. And I was able to monetize my blog That is, get paid for doing it. I did it through the Patreon system. It worked pretty well. I'm not making a huge amount of money, but I'm making enough to pay the light bill. Mm-hmm. And out of that, I have to pay my web manager and the web hosting service and the manager guy who comes with that. So about 30 or 35% of my Patreon stuff goes in commissions to them. And then, you know, the credit card companies and Patreon take a cut.
Yeah.
So by the time it's all said and done, you know, I'm just making enough to pay the light bill on my own. But it's better than starving to death. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't have to go out and become a barista. But, you know, that's been sort of the story of my career. When I first started out, you know, I think I may have mentioned to you that when I finished my first novel, I got a literary agent rather quickly. I was working for Rolling Stone at the time, and I was getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to write this horror novel because I had just read Peter Benchley's novel, Jaws.
Was this Bagging Bigfoot?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. I must have told you about that before.
No, you told Duncan. It was on the Constar cast.
Okay.
Years ago.
So I wrote this novel. I decided, well, you know, I can write a better book than Peter Benchley, than better book than Jaws. I didn't think Jaws was very well written. So I decided to, and I was in California because that's where Rolling Stone was at the time, 1975. They didn't move to New York until 2 or 3 years later. And so, you know, I was in California. I thought, oh, I'll write a horror novel about Bigfoot, about two guys chasing Bigfoot around in, you know, Northern California. And I finished the gosh darn thing. I got an agent really surprisingly quickly. And the first thing I did when I got the letter from the, back in the day when you got, you know, you got these things in the mail, you actually had to wait like 5 weeks to hear, right? Unheard of today, of course. So I get the letter. The first thing I do is go down to Van Ness Avenue in downtown San Francisco where all the foreign car dealers are. And I'm pricing out these fancy English sports cars like, you know, the Jensen Interceptor. You know, these are, at the time, those were like $30,000 sports cars. The equivalent of that today would probably be about $300,000, you know, for a Lamborghini or something. So I actually thought I was going to be an overnight bazillionaire.
Who doesn't?
Yeah. And of course, it didn't work. And instead, so at that point, I got on a motorcycle. I had a motorcycle in San Francisco because it was a really great way to get around the city. I had a car for about a month. I bought this beater off of the receptionist at Rolling Stone, and I got towed like 4 times in the first 30 days. And I decided, fuck this. It's crazy. I can't do this. I got a motorcycle instead. I bought a used Honda 350 from a colonel down in the Presidio, which was an army base at the time. It was a sort of a fancy country club army base. Anyway, I rode the darn thing all the way back to Washington, D.C., where I was camping out for a while at a former girlfriend's house in Georgetown, waiting to hear about my giant book contract for the horror novel I wrote, Bagging Bigfoot. And the weeks went by and the weeks went by and nothing was happening. And then the agent called me up and said, you got to rewrite this thing. They're complaining about it. So I rewrote the gosh darn thing in about a month and a half. And then I ran out of money and had to get a job. So I got a job mopping floors in the National Portrait Gallery. So that was my first job after being an editor at Rolling Stone, was mopping floors in the National Portrait Gallery. And then I got a job driving an Arlington yellow taxi cab. And so that was my my first encounter with the pitfalls of publishing. Then I hunkered down in upstate New York, finally, and wrote 8 novels. And after 8 novels, I was still waiting on tables. You know, if I had known that in the beginning, I might have tried out for the Red Sox instead of being, you know, trying to be a novelist. But, you know, amazingly, you know, I had 8 books in print at major publishers and I'm waiting on tables in Saratoga Springs. So I have discovered that, you know, the life in the arts can be severely up and down. Now, you've had a pretty up and down life yourself, perhaps in some ways even more acute than mine. You certainly had more success as a young man than I ever did. But I was at a low spot, and then I wrote The Geography of Nowhere, and I started, you know, living like a normal middle-class person. By the time I was 45 years old, I started making enough money to be able to order stuff from the L.L. Bean catalog, which to me was like the hash mark for where you're really a full-fledged adult,
right?
You know, financially. And, things went pretty well for the next 20 years or so. But then a couple of things happened. One was, first of all, I had developed a lively career on the lecture circuit because I was writing some books that people were interested in. You know, I wrote these books about urban design and the fiasco of suburbia. And there are so many people in so many places in America who are disgusted with the places that they live and what has happened to them and how they have been engineered, how they, you know, their political leaders have engineered all the joy and artistry out of the human habitat, you know, and they're living in this demolition derby of an everyday world that they hate. So I actually had a pretty lively career going around to all these civic organizations, talking to them about urban design. And I was making pretty good lecture fees. Most of my income was coming from that. And then I wrote The Long Emergency about the collapse of the American economy and political system, which has sort of been underway. And of course, you know, I called it The Long Emergency for a reason. The reason being that I figured it would go on for a long time and it would be a long kind of grind. And people wanted to hear about that. But then suddenly around 2014-15, the social justice warriors started to get wound up on campus. And pretty soon, nobody wanted a speaker to come on campus who was retailing uncomfortable ideas. And that was me. So my lecture career kind of foundered. And, I still go out once in a while and do civic, organizations or symposia or, conferences about urban planning. But, most of the action was on campus for lecturing, and that dried up completely. And meanwhile, the publishing industry kind of fell apart. And I noticed the other day that Barack Obama and Michelle, the two of them, got a $65 million advance for a couple of books from a subsidiary of Random House. And, you know, that's where all the money is going, to two people instead of going to, I don't know, I don't want to do the math. I'm not that good at math. But let's say 1,416 other authors might have gotten a decent book advance to keep them going on the same money that two people, the Obamas, got paid by Random House. So, you know, otherwise, you know, unless you're a celebrity or a Kardashian, they don't really want to hear from you. And frankly, I'm not quite sure how they're selling so many books or why they're publishing so many books, because I'm not persuaded that people are reading that much anymore, you know, with all the distractions of the internet. But what I decided to do was, you know, in as much as the internet was distracting everybody so badly, was to try to make a living writing on the internet. So I started writing my blog, Clusterfuck Nation, and I did it once a week for about 10 years. And then I decided, you know, I got to give the readers a little more, especially if I'm asking them to make contributions to pay for it. You know, my blog, it doesn't have a paywall, but you can make contributions through Patreon. So I decided I needed to give them more. And I actually really love doing the work. First of all, I love the form. You know, for me, it's an essay twice a week of just under 1,000 words. And I've gotten very comfortable in that form. It's kind of familiar. I did things like it years ago because I was rather early in my journalism career, I was promoted to be a columnist when I worked on the evening paper in Albany, New York, the capital of New York State. In a way, it's just really like becoming a twice-a-week newspaper columnist all over again. I like the discipline. I do it in a fairly stringent way. I get up at 6 o'clock in the morning twice a week and write the thing, you know, for 2.5 hours or so before I put it up at, you know, 9 or 9.30 or something in the morning. I get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, but I may not actually get going until 7 after, you know, the tea kicks in. I love the fact that I don't have to run it through an editor. You know, nobody tells me what to write. Nobody gives me any back talk or bullshit about my opinions. And I have long considered editors to be an obstacle to anything valuable in me expressing myself. You know, I don't like my books to be edited very much. In fact, I try to engineer them as much as possible to be as untouchable as possible. And my favorite word in the editorial process is the word STET, S-T-E-T, mm-hmm. which is copy editing shorthand for keep your fucking hands off of that sentence. It doesn't add up as an acronym, but that's what it means. Anyway, I really like the discipline of it. And finally, I know I've been going on maybe longer than you want me to. Finally, I don't know if there's been a time in my life, except for maybe the last year of Watergate, that was so rich in comic possibilities for writing political commentary. Because our country has gone completely off the rails, out of its mind, batshit crazy. And it is such a fascinating thing to write about, the process. You know, especially if you're assuming that you are actually keeping your sanity while everybody else is losing theirs.
Do you know approximately how many regular readers you have?
Well, I'm sorry to admit this, but the truth is, I don't really keep track of things like that. I'm notoriously remiss in even keeping track of my book sales. I never look at my book sales on Amazon. You know, I depend on my literary agent to vet my royalty reports from the various publishers who chime in. That, who knows? Maybe I'm being swindled. I don't really know. But I don't look at my podcast listening numbers. I don't check into my blog readership. Once in a while, my web manager, Duncan, will inform me sort of offhand or you know, just in casual conversation, but...
This is not Duncan Curry, right?
Yeah, it is Duncan.
Oh, it is Duncan Curry.
Yeah, it's okay. Duncan. Yeah, Duncan has been he was my sidekick on the podcast when it started about, I don't know, 10 years ago or so. And then he decided he was too busy to do it, and I understood why. He's a young guy who wanted to make a living instead of being a free producer of a podcast. So he turned it over to me. And anyway, the answer is I have no idea how many people check in.
How much do you interact with readers?
Well, I interact a lot. First of all, I answer all my own email. I don't have any assistant. I don't have a PA. I don't have any intermediaries. Don't have a secretary. You know, I do all of that. Duncan, my web manager, does not read the... Well, you know, sometimes things come to him one way by happenstance. I'm not sure. Things do get to him. But, you know, mostly anything that comes to my personal email, which is the only email that's actually listed on the blog, you know, I answer personally. People are often surprised that I'm writing back to them, but I don't know. It doesn't seem like a big deal to me. I do get a little bit overwhelmed with email from strangers, but, you know, I mean, it's not like Clark Gable in 1951, you know, getting 5,000 letters a week. Far from it. So I think it's important to do that. I think it's important to interact with my readers. I have made a lot of friends just, you know, answering casual reader mail. I meet really interesting people that way, and some of them have become pretty good friends. So, you know, I don't police the comments section on my blog very rigorously. Once in a while, I go in there. There are a few trolls and pests that I have to deal with, but on the whole, I let it roll. And there are some very obnoxious people on the comment section. You know, a couple of real, there's a couple of white supremacist Nazi people, and people wonder why I keep them on. And one reason is that point of view is out there. And, you know, I think that I think people ought to be aware of what it consists of. And I think one of the reasons that I actually keep those people on the blog is because as odious as their opinions may be, they happen to be pretty polite and fairly intelligent, and they express themselves well. If they were nasty and mean and impolite and outrageously cruel, I'd kick them off. But they're not. So I think that it's important to, you know, to expose their point of view and let the other people debate them, which they do.
What other personality types or ideological champions are attracted to your blog?
Well, interestingly, there are a couple of very formidable women commenters and readers. One of them is from England, and she seems to be fascinated with the meltdown in American politics. But she's very, you know, she's very, very intelligent.
Meltdown in British politics, too.
Well, yeah, because the UK is not in good shape politically or economically, as we are. There are a number of women who I find very interesting because they're not, you know, they have not been capped. They're not hostage to the programmatic ideology that has taken so many women hostage in our culture. You know, they're not full of pre-cooked ideas and canned shibboleths and you know, all this sort of annoying dogma. I enjoy that the most. It pleases me a great deal to hear and to see people expressing original thoughts and things that seem to, you know, not be received wisdom or conventional thinking. So there's quite a bit of that. I think there are a number of people on my blog comment roll who are probably alt-rightish. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I got an email from a guy the other day who's also a blogger. He's an architectural blogger named Dave Broussette from Providence, Rhode Island. He used to be the architecture writer for the Providence newspaper. But like so many newspapers, you know, they cut out just about every position they could, including his. And now he's, you know, trying to make a career in the alternate universe of the internet. And he sent me a letter the other day saying, gee, I thought you were a liberal. And I said, well, I'm a registered Democrat, but I wouldn't call myself a liberal. On the other hand, I'm not a Republican and I'm not a conservative in the way that most people might understand that today. I'm basically off the reservation. And I appreciate other minds, political minds, who are also off the reservation, because the reservations are such tightly policed and tightly controlled, you know, thought corrals. They're like thought prisons. I don't want to be in any of those thought prisons. And I'm amazed at what has happened to the thinking class in our country. In fact, I've been that's been the subject of a lot of my recent blogs, is how astonishing it is that the class of people who are paid to think in this country are doing such a poor job of thinking. You know, what has happened to these people? What's your theory?
Oh, I think, what's his name? Kissinger. Henry Kissinger articulated it pretty well. An expert is somebody who articulates the needs of power. So to be a public intellectual and get paid, you know, to be on MSNBC or NPR or, you know, Fox or whatever, you need to be able to get up and with a straight face talk at length about things that absolutely don't matter and are distantly related at best to reality.
Well, you know, I think that's responsible for part of the problem of the thinking class not thinking anymore. But maybe I'm not sufficiently cynical. You know, I'm not cynical enough. What I wonder about is, let's say, you know, that for me, that would be maybe 18% of why they behave the way they do. Mm-hmm. But the other, 82%? Is that math right?
Yes.
The other 82% is the most astounding cowardly behavior and craven behavior. By the way, you see the same thing in the universities that you see in the media. You know, you have to ask yourself, how can a university president or a dean put up with behavior on the faculty of people who aggressively want to shut down speech and debate? I mean, how can they do that in good conscience and go along with that? And yet, you know, where are the college presidents speaking out about that? Where are the college presidents who are, you know, what they're doing is they're punishing the people who actually believe in free expression. You know, the people like Professor Amy Wax at UPenn Law School, who has been expressing herself fairly freely and has been severely punished by her fellow faculty members. She wrote a piece last summer with a co-author from, I think, San Diego State. And the argument in the article was it would be really probably a beneficial thing if we promoted what used to be called bourgeois values among the, you know, the poor and the people who are not making it in this society, who are largely or at least partly not making it because their behavior is so bad, you know? And so she argued it would be a good thing to promote ideas like being polite, showing up on time, being earnest, being frugal. You know, this whole list of bourgeois, quote, bourgeois values. And she was absolutely castigated for this. Of course, she was labeled a racist for suggesting this. Of course, her suggestions were labeled as white privilege. And then, you know, she started being jerked around and blackballed and you know, shunned and punished by her fellow faculty members at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. And then about 2 months ago, she had the effrontery to go on Glenn Lurie's podcast. Glenn Lurie is a black economics professor at Brown University. And she had a frank conversation with him about what she'd observed about the performance of the black students at the Penn Law School. And her point, which was not a particularly appetizing point, but nonetheless what she believed to be true, was that they weren't performing very well. You know, for one reason or another, they were performing badly. And she would, you know, she presented this as a statement of, you know, her personal experience as a law professor. And by the way, Amy Wax, Professor Amy Wax is a very distinguished and smart lady. She went to Harvard Medical School, graduated cum laude, and decided instead of becoming a doctor, she decided to go to law school and become a lawyer. So she's, you know, an extremely accomplished person with a deep scientific background and training. And yet, you know, she's being punished and shunned by her colleagues. And so, you know, the idea that the president of the University of Pennsylvania or the dean of the law school would encourage that, you know, people to treat her that way, it's just appalling to me. But it's going on all over the country. And it's worth going to the podcast with her and Glenn Lurie, Lurey, I think.
So I'm not particularly versed in the content that Jordan Peterson puts out. From what I've heard, it's mildly interesting, but it's clearly I'm not the target demographic. It's, you know, he's talking to younger men. And so I'm just not that interested, but my son is a big fan of Jordan Peterson. And I see attacks on Peterson from what I call the blue tribe. You know, there's the red tribe and the blue tribe, and I am neither. I feel equally alienated from both, although more frustrated with the blue tribe, because I expect more from them.
Yeah, I mean, the way I feel, it's like, those are my people. The blue tribe is what used to be the thinking class.
Right.
And they're no longer thinking. So, of course, it's appalling to see that.
So I don't know a whole lot about Jordan Peterson, but I can see that the attacks against him are 90% in bad faith.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So this, if it weren't for the fact that I know that my son is a Jordan Peterson devotee, I might be less interested in the whole topic. But it's emblematic for me of a growing intellectual dishonesty on the left.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the greatest virtue of Jordan Peterson's endeavors is simply how brave he's been in the face of continual attack, not a whole lot of support, certainly not from his colleagues.
Well, he's getting plenty of financial support from his fans.
Well, he is, and he's selling a lot of books now because he wrote a book that it's actually a book that I was thinking about writing a book like that. He wrote a book called,
12 Rules for Life.
Right. And it's aimed at young men and understanding, you know, what are some of the important, really crucial behaviors that you need to adopt in order to succeed at human life on this planet.
I sent a copy to my son.
Great. I haven't read it yet, but I've certainly listened to many of his lectures on YouTube about the subject, so I'm familiar with where he's coming from. I have a book underway that, you know, I've been writing pieces of it for years called Young Man Blues, Notes on a Nervous Adolescence. And it's about growing up, and it's about dealing with teenage anxiety. So it's a little bit different from Peterson's book. But, you know, essentially, we're dealing with essentially the same thing. You know, how does a young male develop into something like real manhood successfully? And especially, how do you navigate through that period of your life, you know, where the part of your brain that is responsible for judgment has not developed very well? And, you know, I think the rule of thumb is that before the age of 24 or 25, it's not really fully developed in the male of the human species.
And I had it developed at about age 40 is when it really kicked in.
Yeah, well, I had some very powerful experiences at 24 and 25 that, you know, combined with me just reaching that age that kicked it in for me, and I was floundering before that, and after that I wasn't floundering. I wasn't necessarily getting rich, that's for sure, and I still had, you know, some delusions, but they were at least adult delusions,
right?
You know, like thinking I was going to make $1 million selling a horror novel in, you know, in 5 minutes. But I think it's a very important question, especially in a society that is as screwed up as ours, is, you know, how are young men going to be guided into some kind of, you know, initiation into true manhood? And there's very little to assist them out there. And they get almost no help at all from the culture in general. In fact, if anything, these days they get almost nothing but discouragement, and you know, they get kind of pushed around and dissed and made to feel bad about even wanting to get to a place that might be called manhood. Manhood itself, I think, is been denigrated and you know, thrown into the dumpster of history by the blue people out there. It troubles me a lot. Now, personally, I don't have to deal with it anymore because I'm 69 years old. But, you know, I'd be concerned. So, but I do think that your son is fortunate that if he is a Jordan Peterson fan, and if he is on that side of the fence for now, it's just probably to borrow a phrase from the red, excuse me, from the blue people, it's probably a safer place or a safer space than to be blue.
Yeah.
Because that's going nowhere. You know, that is a grab bag of delusions and hallucinations and figments that is so transparently false and dishonest that, you know, this is the thing about dishonesty and falsity, you know. It really lacks permanence because people discover very quickly that it doesn't comport with reality. You know, things that don't comport with reality, you know, don't really have resilience or sustainability. And so even though I'm very troubled about the state of our culture, I'm serenely confident that the tide is going to turn. And at some point, you know, we're going to become a less delusional culture than we have been lately.
And that harkens back to our conversation earlier, which the listeners didn't hear when you were asking the questions and I was answering.
Just to be clear, I was interviewing you for a book that I'm writing now, and we did that about 2 hours ago.
But I was saying that we're in a time when, you know, making contact with reality requires an extra effort, and breaking contact with reality is not only effortless, but there is lots of encouragement and hand-holding and enablement.
Support.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the ways that this shows up is that, you know, all of the virtue signaling that is going on among the blues has become their primary activity is not done for no reason at all. It's done for basically for collecting brownie points, you know, and some of them are very serious brownie points. For example, if you're in the university system and, you know, you're among the blue Antifa social justice warrior, you know, guardians of righteousness.
Now, Antifa and social justice warrior are not two categories that blend seamlessly together.
No, they're not seamless. It's true. It's true. Although they tend to be in the service of one another.
Right.
But my point being basically that the people who support that in academia are getting a lot of brownie points for career advancement, you know, for support among their colleagues. It's a kind of a circle jerk of approbation. And, you know, there are status rewards and financial rewards. You know, you get a higher salary. You get promoted to tenure. You know, you get all kinds of advantages from behaving that way in this terrible, pernicious groupthink atmosphere. So there are a lot of rewards involved. There's another thing about the whole social justice movement that I think people don't understand at all is increasingly it is not at all about ideology or ideas per se, or certainly not about really about justice or fairness. It's about coercion. It's about the pleasures of coercion and the pleasures of pushing other people around. I think that is insufficiently appreciated.
I think if you don't believe that that's the case, then there's no evidence that somebody can show you to convince you. But if you're willing to put on that frame and then you go and you watch any number of interactions online between, you know, social justice warriors and the people that they are castigating, it comes through very clearly.
Yeah.
What do you think of the whole supposedly youth-led march on Washington about assault weapons?
Well, you know, I didn't have very strong feelings about it at all. I mean, I think that from the starting point of what provoked it, which is a massacre in a high school, mm-hmm. you know, it's hard to find a worse example of social dysfunction than children being slaughtered in school. So that incident itself and incidents like it ought to be extremely disturbing to anybody with a social conscience or any conscience at all. And you can understand why it would provoke all kinds of strong feelings and strong reactions. I can understand why it would provoke a lot of bad feeling about firearms. I happen to be a firearm owner. In fact, I am licensed in New York State to carry a concealed handgun.
You need no such license in Vermont.
Well, any old joker can do it here.
Yeah, for now.
It's a lot more stringent over in New York State. Now, I happened to get into it by happenstance. I didn't actually seek to do it per se. I mean, I had a girlfriend who was fond of hiking, going on solo hikes in the Adirondacks, in the mountains. I wasn't doing it with her because at the time, you know, was going through a series of hip replacements, and hiking, mountain climbing wasn't my thing during the years that we were together. Right. I could probably do it again now, but at the time I wasn't. But anyway, she was encountering some sketchy people on her hikes up there, and she wanted to get a handgun license. And she asked me to come and take the course with her. And I did. And, you know, once I completed it and I got my certificate, I thought, well, I got a certificate. Why not just buy a handgun? So I did.
That's kind of a late introduction to that culture.
Well, I wasn't part of the culture. First of all, you know, I grew up in Manhattan, so I didn't go out hunting with Dad on November afternoons. You know, I went to the Museum of Modern Art. However, you know, one of the things I did in summer camp was shoot rifles. So I knew how to fire a firearm. I knew how to handle one safely. When I did move to upstate New York as an adult, I did take a gun safety course in order to get a hunting license, because for a few years I was kind of interested in bird shooting, even though I hardly ever did it. But I did take the gun safety course for the rifles, and then I had to take it again for the handgun. So anyway, we were straying a little bit from the subject, which is, you know, the kids marching in Washington against firearms. And, you know, I can understand why they did it. To some extent, I do wonder a bit how much they're being manipulated by one side or the other, and my guess is quite a bit. You know, that they're being used as pawns in a game, but I don't have strong feelings one way or the other. I guess I do feel that there's no reason why civilians should be buying tactical military weapons. You know, I think there are certain boundaries that we ought to probably consider about that. On the other hand, I must say this, that I take a certain amount of comfort in the idea that there are a lot of firearms in America, because, you know, I think that there are a lot of forces in America that have tremendous potential to be coercive and destructive to our lives, you know, starting with the government and the intelligence agencies and all the people who are collecting information about us and would like to control our lives one way or another. So I think it's kind of a useful thing for them to be aware that there are a lot of firearms out there, and if they piss off enough people, that it won't be a good thing for them.
Well, if you're going to get home by dark, you need to get on the road. So, thank you.
Let me ask you one question, though.
Sure.
Do you think that that's an incoherent argument, or?
No, I don't own any firearms, but, you know, as I told you earlier, my father was a Secret Service agent, and from the time I was old enough to form permanent memories, there were always weapons in the house. And
did you get any training?
Well, I got, like, you know, from the time I was a toddler, I didn't even, you know, the notion of gun safety wasn't even in my head. It's just it was drilled into me so early that this is how you handle firearms, and if you're going to go out and shoot, you know, this is how you do it. And, you know, I had a rifle from kindergarten.
Oh, wow.
So, and my father was an old West and Civil War history buff, and he loved to ride horses. So I grew up shooting guns and riding horses.
Was he in either World War II or Korea?
No.
Vietnam or anything?
He was the right age for Vietnam, but no, he didn't serve. He was in the Air Force, but he didn't He was never in anything to do with the VSP.
Well, he must have had a lot of training of all kinds along those lines.
Well, I think more in the Secret Service than in the military. But I've had no... I was not a hunter. I was living in a place where I could have gone hunting if I'd been of a mind to. And my father would go on hunting trips, and he never brought anything back. You know,
A lot of guys go hunting just to hang out with their buddies and drink, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
So the whole firearms thing is weird for me because I grew up in an environment where they were utterly mundane, nothing special whatsoever, not threatening, but not alluring either. And it's like the criticism of Jordan Peterson, the criticism or the impassioned need to disarm the citizenry on the part of the Blue Tribe seems really disingenuous to me. It's like, of all the things that are a problem and that could kill you, being in a public spectacle shooting is very, very low on the list. You know, just getting in a car presents a much greater danger. The food you eat is a much greater danger than being caught in some violent incident like that. But it seems that the Blue Tribe gravitates to a problem where the solution is the humiliation of the Red Tribe. To confiscate and denigrate the totem, you know, and a gun is a totem of the Red Tribe, because I think they pick the problem based on the solution. The solution is we get to rub their nose in it, so that's the problem, you know.
Yeah, that brings us back to coercion.
Yeah. So, again, to me, the hysteria over firearms, it seems to come from a place of dishonesty.
Yeah.
And so while I'm not, I don't have any of my own, I don't plan to acquire any, I do not get behind at all any push for gun control right now, even with stuff that seems fairly reasonable. You know, there probably isn't much need for an AR-15. The AR-15, though, is so reconfigurable that it can be a hunting weapon. It can be reconfigured to be an effective and sensible weapon for hunting deer, moose, bear, whatever. Unfortunately, it's also really good at killing people. I don't know. I just have, it's not my issue. Except to say that for the people for whom it is their issue, unless they have actually been involved or have been the victim of gun violence, in which case I still don't agree with them, but I'm not going to contradict them because, you know, it's coming from such a primal place. There'd be no point in, you know, discussing it. I just don't support it.
Fair enough.
And, you know, regardless of what the crazy bad writers back in the 18th century, we're trying to convey, it has been understood for at least a century here in the United States that the Second Amendment means that citizens can be armed without necessarily being, you know, in a military organization of some kind. That's been the received wisdom on what that document means for a good long time. So to change it now, it seems a curtailment of rights, and I'm not interested in that. I didn't mention in all of my discussion of my past, you know, the ideological arc that I've been on, because when I was working at Amazon, I was a doctrinaire, hardcore libertarian, as in Libertarian Party. And I've put a lot of that behind me. I mean, mostly because libertarians that I see these days, you know, articulating the straighter libertarian line really just seem like, you know, laissez-faire Republicans who don't want to pay taxes. You know, they don't seem real. Because what brought me to the libertarian viewpoint was its principled stand against the drug war. And so many so-called libertarians that I've encountered over the years are totally fine with the drug war, which to me says you're not a libertarian. You're a Republican who doesn't want to pay taxes. So anyway, could go on a long rant about that. I won't.
All right.
But hey, it's been a bunch of fun.
It's been a pleasure.
On the Sea Realm podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back, never go back never to go its back, old dimensions. Back.
All right, that was James Howard Kunstler. He is an author of novels and nonfiction books, and he writes twice a week for his blog. His blog is called Clusterfuck Nation, but unless you want to get a porn site that's probably going to try to put some spyware on your device, better to go to Kunstler.com and then click on the blog link. Alrighty, I'm not going to ramble a lot here at the end of the podcast. I do want to tell you, though, that I am drawing a comic strip now. I'm the co-creator of it, and I'm creating the backstory, doing the world building, but we have another writer who is responsible for taking the information that I generate and crafting it into something approaching a joke with a punchline and, you know, something that'll get a laugh in each strip. But I am drawing this comic strip for a political organization called Center for Progressive Urban Politics, or CFPUP, C-F-P-U-P. So you can find the comic by going to cfpup.org. At present, there is no link to it from crealm.com. That will change eventually, but maybe not in the coming days. But again, the website is Center for Progressive Urban Politics, or cfpup.org. And the comic strip is called Terra Inferma. So right now, to get to it, it is the far rightmost tab at the top of the website. Terra Inferma is the name of the comic strip. Again, the website is cfpup.org. So I hope that you'll check it out and send me some feedback. Probably, I don't think there's a way to leave comments on that website right now, but the best way to give me feedback would be to post something to the Friends of the Sea Realm group on Facebook, or send me something via email. My email address is kmo@crealm.com. That's the letter C and then a dash and then R-E-A-L-M, crealm.com. That is all for this episode of the Sea Realm Podcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to everybody who subscribes to the Sea Realm Vault Podcast. And until you next hear my voice, please stay well.